we have to move on maybe with a little more speed than we have been hitherto, because I don't feel I even come to the, by any means, the most powerful arguments against the theory of evolution yet. We've come to some things that have been brought up by people writing textbooks, but I believe that the most powerful arguments are still unsaid in this class. The first thing I want to do this morning, however, is discuss a few points. I'm not going to attempt to go into them exhaustively. First of all, because I'm not qualified, but secondly, because we just haven't got time, with respect to the geological record, because there's something about the word fossil and strata and so forth that seems to, when it's given out, it seems to be a word that is supposed to automatically hit you over the head with a baseball bat to club you into believing into evolution. As soon as the guy says fossil, you're supposed to say, yep, look up, I'm nervous, I'm all upset, and you're supposed to say, well, I didn't know anything about fossils. He said, well, there's fossils, and you're supposed to believe in evolution, I guess. So I want to bring out about 8 points with respect to the fossil record that I believe are, maybe you don't know about them. If you do, it won't hurt you to hear about them again, which I believe are exceedingly damaging to the theory of evolution. Now, yesterday we talked about what's on the board here. If evolution be true, one, the oldest rock should contain fossils of a small number of simple creatures. And remember that we said the oldest rocks of all don't contain any fossils. But the first fossil-bearing rocks, which they call a Cambrian, bear every kind of a fossil except the vertebrates. And some of them are mighty complicated creatures. So, number one doesn't seem to gel with the facts. Number two, intermediate forms should show a gradual change to a greater variety of more complex forms and more recent rocks. Well, as we said yesterday, the intermediate forms just aren't there. This, in my view, is fatal to the theory of evolution if you want to prove it by the fossil record. But I think the least you can say, which evolutionists themselves admit, is it's very damaging to the theory. They wish they had more. And I put up what Simpson said, that he said only about 10% of 10% of the fossils were available. And he said this was pretty gloomy, but he hoped it wasn't fatal to the theory. Well, so much for that. Now these 8 points with respect to the geological record, I now want to go through rather fast, with one exception, which we'll slow down for and which we'll come to in a minute. But number one is this, and this I think is getting awfully close to fraud on the part of evolutionists, but certainly, in my view at least, illogical. Up to 1945, the only method, you can write this down, give yourself a summary of what I'm saying now, the only method available for dating the layers of rock was what is known as circular reasoning. Now let me explain what I mean. A high school professor takes a group of students out to the side of a cliff down in Tennessee or Hamilton or wherever it is, and there's layers of rock there. So they walk over and one of the students says, sir, how old is this layer here? So the only method up until 1945 that they had was, the professor would say, just a minute, I'll get my axe. So he would get a little hatchet and he would start chipping away on this layer until he came to a fossil. Then he would pull a fossil out and he'd go to his textbook and say, just a minute now and I'll tell you. He'd go to one of these geological tables that I talked about yesterday. On one column would be column of vertebrates, you know, up the line from protozoa right up to mammals. And on the other column would be the rocks and these names they've given them from Cambrian right up. And on the next column would be the number of years. So if he got a fossil, say of a turtle out of that chipping, he'd go down here, turtles, oh yeah, That's how that letter is dated. Well, and this is really proving the theory by the theory. And this, in my view, is not a logical way to go about a thing. On the other hand, if a couple of days later, that's a geology class, the biology teacher took a group of students out, and they came to the same group of rocks, and they chipped away, and they found a fossil, and they said to the guy, how old is this fossil? He would also go to the same book and table and go down and say, oh yeah, what's the fossil again? Well, it's a turtle. Turtle. Oh yeah, fine. That's Silurian. And how old Silurian? It's 6 zillion years old again. Well, this is known as what's reasoning in a circle. In other words, you prove the age of the fossils by the rocks. And you prove the age of the rocks by the fossils. This is something like saying that I now want to get climbed up into the air. So the first thing I do is raise my right foot a foot in the air, and then I raise my left foot a foot, and I start climbing up. The only thing that's wrong with that is it doesn't happen. So the theory of dating the rocks by the fossils and the fossils by the rocks is just reasoning in a circle. You're using the theory of evolution as a foregone conclusion, and then you're building a table upon that. But that isn't what evolutionists have to prove at all. They have to prove the righteousness of the table. So you can't use the table and use this kind of reasoning to prove the rightness of it. And this is awfully close to fraud, really. I mean, this is putting it over people a bit, in my view. To write a textbook as if this whole thing is absolutely set down and, you know, we know when this is how you're doing it, is getting pretty close to fraud. However, whether it's fraud or not, it certainly is illogical. I said that this was the only method up until 1945. In 1945, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Libby came out with an entirely new method, which was hailed as the end-all of a method of dating rocks. And this is what's known as the carbon-14 method. And any of you who have read books since 1945, and most of you are in school now reading books printed since then, will have pages and pages and pages about how what a marvelous thing the carbon-14 dating is. Now, it just so happens that we are fortunate in having in our midst Dr. Jeff Nicholson, who is a brother and who is a graduate of the University of London in high-temperature chemistry. He is a research man with 3M in St. Paul, Minnesota. And he is much more qualified than I am to discuss the carbon-14 method of dating. So I'm now going to ask Brother Jeff to come forward and speak to that point.
Well, first of all, Brother Farrer did it again. He approached me last night and said, well, you should know something about carbon-14. I'll tell you a little bit about it. I don't know a great deal about it. I'm no expert, and I don't profess to be an expert over those who have published many scientific matters on it. However, the information that I have may be of interest to you. Brother Farrell said it was Dr. Libby in 1946 who first brought out the technique of measuring the age of rocks and fossils by carbon-14 dating. At the same time, I must add that Dr. Libby did, and still is, questioning, or he brings up the many variables and assumptions on which this technique hinges. However, as Brother Farrell says, this was grasped by the scientific community as a technique of helping or illustrating the evolutionary theory. Let's just talk a little bit about the technique. What do we have at the present time? Okay. So, at the present time, for these two he says, since 1946. Very simply, it was noted that cosmic rays plus atoms were capable of giving neutrons. I'm not trying to give you a course in nuclear physics. But these neutrons, when they react with nitrogen, give carbon-14. Now carbon-14 is radioactive. Now carbon-14 decays. To form other elements, and I'm presuming it forms boron, although perhaps someone else might be able to tell me more precisely the series here. But in any case, it decays. Now how can we tell the age of something which contains carbon-14 if it decays? Well, it's been measured that let's say we take a pound of carbon-14. It decays to half a pound of carbon-14, and it's been measured that this takes of the order of 5,500 years, approximately. So here is a measure. Something contains carbon-14, it decays, and it'll decay to half of its amount in 5,500 years. This is called the half-life of the element, or the isotope. Well then, today, as we know it, and can measure it, carbon-14 is being formed by the cosmic rays from space, reacting on the nitrogen, forming carbon-14. And so that in the atmosphere today, we have carbon dioxide. This is the principal form, perhaps, of carbon in combination. Let's take then a living creature today. It's living. Well, let's take a plant. It absorbs, as you all know, carbon dioxide by photosynthesis. And so, this living plant will contain a certain amount of carbon-14, and of course ordinary carbon as we know it. So this living plant, it'll have a certain carbon-14 to carbon ratio, and this will be a constant. There's a constant amount of carbon-14 to carbon in the atmosphere, and so in the plant there will be a constant amount of carbon-14 to carbon. Now, the plant dies. So now we have a dead plant. Well, of course, the plant now is no longer taking in carbon dioxide. So, the carbon-14 in the plant decays, and the amount of carbon-14 to carbon becomes less, because the carbon-14 is gradually decaying. So if we take that plant and measure the amount of carbon-14, and we assume that today the carbon-14 to carbon ratio has a certain constant value, and that when we measure that carbon-14 to carbon content, the value is less, we can work out the age of that plant. What have we assumed? We've assumed that this is a constant. What else can we assume? We can assume this one here. We're assuming that the cosmic rays,
and right.
I hope this is made by Brianna. We have also assumed that the rate at which carbon-14 is being made is a constant. In other words, okay, first of all, we assume that the carbon 14 to carbon ratio is constant. And secondly, we assume that the cosmic radiation is constant. Two pretty big assumptions. But many people, as I say, think that carbon 14 dating then is verified. But Dr. Livy himself, in The American Scientist in 1956, he recognized that it was difficult to establish dates of millions of years ago, as he had no point of reference. He admitted that archaeology could only go back as far as the first dynasty in Egypt. So carbon dating can only be checked from the time period of the flood. Prior to the flood, we can only extrapolate. It's like having a graph like this and having a few little points up here and drawing a straight line through there. How many of us have done that at school? I know I have. So, from way back here in time, we have no check. However, in this time period, in the short time period, radiocarbon dating has been shown to be reasonably accurate. We have to admit this. Well, what are the other variations that could have an effect on this radiocarbon dating technique? Dr. Hunt in 1955 particularly emphasizes contamination. The possible contamination of the carbon to carbon 14 ratio with carbon from other sources. He says that in approaching carbon 14 dates, it is essential always to discriminate between the carbon 14 age and the actual age of the sample. He says, laboratory analysis does not show whether the carbon in the fossil is the original or a secondary. They can't determine between that which has come from some secondary part. Another point, when measuring these long periods of time of millions of years, if there are local variations in the carbon 14 content, then this can produce very large errors in the measurements. For example, we all know that, this is just a side, there are tremendous variations in the fluoride content of water. Many people complain about adding fluoride to water, where there are large concentrations of fluoride in water in other parts of the world. We also have another problem. Recently, there has been quite a lot of burning of fossil fuels, such as coal, oil, and this has contaminated the atmosphere by diluting it. There is more normal carbon in the fossils, because they have aged, than in the surrounding carbon dioxide as we have it. So we have been contaminating our atmosphere quite badly during the last 100 or so years with a high concentration of normal carbon. So this is bound to affect the dating technique. Well, let's take another thing. Let's consider the flood. First of all, let's accept the flood. We're told about it in scripture. So if we... Right. I hope I'm not taking too long.
Go ahead.
So if we consider the flood, it's highly probable that before the flood, the ratio of carbon 14 to carbon was very small. Well, we ask the reason why. Well, let's look at it. Let's look at the Earth. surrounded by water vapor, a high concentration of water vapor. The cosmic rays can't penetrate water vapor. What do instead? Well, they form neutrons. The neutrons attack the water, and as you know, in water we have hydrogen. Hydrogen plus neutrons, we get deuterium, another isotope of hydrogen. And if we add more neutrons to that, we get tritium, another isotope of hydrogen. It's rather, and the tritium decays to form helium-3. This is radioactive. It decays very rapidly to form helium-3. The interesting part here is that in our present time, just considering the cosmic radiation, there is insufficient helium, there would be insufficient helium made to account for the actual amount of helium that we have presently in the atmosphere. There is a large amount of helium-3 in the atmosphere, more than can be accounted for in our present time. However, if there was a flood, and if there was a highly saturated atmosphere of water vapor, this could account for a large quantity of helium-3, and of course it could also account for the small quantity of carbon-14. Another interesting fact which I remembered was that it's a peculiarity that the body has some mechanism or means of rejecting radioactive isotopes. Now they don't reject them all. I'm not suggesting that. If we eat, for example, some calcium, which we do in fact get in milk, which is radioactive, we don't absorb all of that radioactive calcium, yet we tend to absorb the natural calcium. This has only been discovered fairly recently. The body has some natural technique of rejecting the harmful radioactive isotope of calcium. Not totally, but some of it. I would like to pose the question, does the living plants have some method of rejecting carbon-14 and hence making the amount of carbon-14 in the plant small? And therefore, because the amount of carbon-14 is small, its age would be rather large. Yes?
Would you say that the reason reaction takes place more slowly is because of Graham's law of fusion that would state that these slower moving atoms, which are radioactive and heavier in their mass, would react more slowly because of the kinetic reaction, a consideration of statistical kinetics would leave them at a slower reaction rate?
This could be, but in fact, not to the degree of rejection that we get. The only marked differences that we can see, for example, we can see differences between hydrogen and deuterium because their atomic masses are 1 and 2. But when we get to something like calcium, their masses are very much greater. Such as, just trying to think of the atomic weight of calcium. It's about 35, yeah. 35? But the point is that the isotopes are so close together with respect to their total mass that this would not account for the large rejection of the radioactive isotope. It was rather a puzzle and rather amazing to them that the body has the capability of rejecting something which could damage the body. Now, just last night, I was talking to Brother Swan, and he told me that In the scientific journal of Nature, just recently, there was an article, I think it was just a few months ago, where they took some trees which were extremely old. Now they were able to measure the ages of the trees independently by counting the rings. But they found that there was a discrepancy between the carbon-14 aging and the measured aging of the rings. Now this is just a very recently published article, and there are many articles which throw doubt on radioactive dating, on its reliability. There are too many variables. So what I'm saying is that radioactive dating in itself doesn't prove one thing or another. It's a useful tool, it's a useful gun. But what we have to do is take into account if this is ambiguous and a problem and doesn't show us one thing or the other thing, then we have to look at other evidence which is much more definite. Now, it's man's desire to look at this radioactive dating as a definite and fixed and well-established thing. Why? Because he wants to reject God. I don't know any other scientific theory which has so much evidence against it and yet still remains a scientific theory. If anyone else knows of a scientific theory, I would be very grateful to know, that has so much evidence stacked against it. God certainly has sent us, I think, very strong delusions. I hope. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brother Nicholson. That was very much to the point that we wish to make, namely that carbon-14, while being a useful tool, is by no means a certain and infallible method of dating. Some of you may know Brother Don Elliott. He gave me an article out of Scientific American a few months ago in which it was reported that scientists had carbon dated some fossils in the muck at the bottom of a river and came up with them. I forget what it was. I should have brought it with me, but I didn't. I think it was something like in the nature of 50,000 years old. And then one of them said, well, let's try the living shellfish right on the bottom of the river. They're alive now. Let's see what they did. And for some strange reason, probably contamination, as Brother Nicholson has said, the living ones on the floor of the river that were alive dated much older, according to the method, than the ones buried in the muck in fossil form. If any of you want the date of that, I will get it for you, because I'm not just dreaming this up. This was a documented and very complicated documented article as well.
Now, you're just discussing just the carbon in the living cycle, I mean in the animals in the science. But I believe in another Scientific American journal, they had an explanation of paleontological nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy with consideration to Geiger-Mueller method of typing your decay activity according to both discrimination of the three types and energies, and you can come a long, long way closer to what you're coming to than you will with carbon, because some of these elements, especially up around the higher end of the periodic table, have a much longer half-life. And whereas with carbon you go through several half-lives, you can go through maybe 3/4 of one on a higher decay series chart.
Brother Nicholson?
One thing that's all about here, I think, is that if you have a longer half-life, it makes your instruments more accurate. But this doesn't get away from the things which I brought up, which are the possible variations which can louse up all these elements anyway. Sure,
if you have a longer half-life, your instruments can measure it more accurately. But all the other arguments which I presented still fall. It just makes you an accurate measurement, more accurate measurement.
Well, I confess I am not qualified to discuss the fine points of this matter that you brought up, Fred. However, my only point is that in college textbooks, and we're dealing here with lay people as well, paragraph 14, rightly or wrongly, I believe you will agree, has been hailed as an exceedingly valuable, if not infallible, tool in the paper of fossils and things they find. All we're trying to do is to show you that the infallibility thereof is not necessarily so. Well, will you hold your question? I do want to cover quickly the other things I have here, and time is of the essence. We've covered 2 points now with respect to the geological idea. One is that up to this time, 1945 certainly, this rather peculiar method of dating the fossils by the rocks and the rocks by the fossils was employed. Then we discussed carbon 14 and its lack of infallibility. Now I wish to discuss another point, and that is that, this is number 3, that in many parts of the world, the strata are out of order. Now originally, around the turn of the middle of last century, when this business of examining the strata of the earth became really active, it was done mostly in Europe. And they did find that so-called simpler structures were at the lower end of the stratum, and as they went up the strata, the higher and more complex creatures did appear in certain areas of Europe, Germany particularly. But, and they said this is the natural order, and it seemed to fit in with the theory of evolution very well. But what is natural? In many parts of the world, the order is completely upside down. And one of the principal places is in Montana, where there are 2,500 square miles of very prolific strata, which are completely the reverse in order. So, of course, evolution is trying to explain this, and they explain it by saying that the whole business, here's the strata like the pages of a book, the whole business must have been flipped over like that, and therefore it's upside down at some time subsequent to the laying down of the strata. Now, this would be all right, I guess, if you were talking about, say, a city block. Everything was in perfect order, except they found one city block that was turned upside down. And maybe on the edges of that, there was evidence of a catastrophe, an earthquake, which had thrust it over. But it's difficult for me, maybe it isn't difficult for you, but it's very difficult for me to believe that 2,500 square miles of territory can be flipped over without, if you please, any evidence of such a thrust. It's just assumed there must have been a thrust, but no evidence of it whatsoever. Now this is documented fairly well, I think, in the book at the back called The Genesis Flood and the bibliography which he refers to in respect to that. Point 4, and I think this is very important too. Nowhere in the world can you find one of these geological tables extant. The only place you find them is in college textbooks. Usually there is only one layer. Sometimes there is two. Very infrequently there is three, and almost nowhere there is four of these layers stacked one on top of another. But nowhere is the whole geological strata set down. Not even in the Grand Canyon, which is miles deep. Now this isn't what you would normally get by reading a college textbook. You would get that all you had to do was to go out somewhere on a Saturday afternoon with your geological professor and go down to the bottom of a valley and chisel in, and you'd find minute creatures, and chisel up a little higher and you'd find more complex, and when you got to the top of the hill you'd find great fossils of horses or something laying there. and that you can do this in almost any part of the world. This ain't so. In fact, if you put together all the strata that they have found and have cataloged throughout the face of the earth, you would find the thing was 26 miles high. These onion skin layers that I talked about yesterday. Now this is, again, it isn't fraudulent, quite, but it's getting awfully close to it. To act in a college textbook as if this thing can be seen almost anywhere you want to go out on a Saturday afternoon. Number five is this. In many parts of the world, the strata are alleged to have been laid down over countless eons of time. But in many parts of the world, right in, smack in the middle of a whole range of these layers, will be a tree sitting there. For some reason or other, it never got knocked over when the deluge came. Now in the Creation Research Society 1966 manual, there are about three articles with illustrations of whole trees smack right in the middle of these strata, which indicate that either the tree lived eons of time, or else these layers were laid down in a very short time. Take your pick. But not quite what they're telling you in the textbook, that this whole thing is running like a dollar watch. The six, so we'll put down there trees in strata, whole trees. Number six, the whole theory of evolution is based on the proposition of uniformitarianism. That's a pretty long word, but what it means is that all things continue as they were from the beginning. That the present is the key to the past. This, in spite of great evidences of catastrophes, of which I think the Genesis flood, whether you agree with everything in that book or not, certainly indicates that there have been tremendous catastrophes take place on the face of this planet. But perhaps one of the most damaging evidences of the fact that things have not continued as they were since the beginning, and that uniformitarianism is not correct, is the discovery in Siberia of these mammoths, where there are whole, huge animals, thousands of them, frozen in a perfect state of composure, some of them with green grass still in their mouths, many of them with undigested green vegetation in their stomachs, and it has been reported that even the meat is fit to eat. And some people have even thought it out and tried it. Now, how a thing the size of an elephant could suddenly be buried in this ice without a catastrophe happening is difficult for me to understand. And so the problem of uniformitarianism needs to be in question. Now, the seventh thing I want to touch on is this. And when you write this down, I don't know if any of you are writing that, but if you haven't written anything yet, write this down, will you? The confounding of succession with relationship. That one form has been subsequent to another in time. In other words, if there's layers here, and there's one fellow there, and there's another fellow higher up, which you say comes later, because time is flowing in this direction, doesn't necessarily mean that this guy is descended from this guy. Now, this is a very important point. I don't know whether I understand logic or not. I've been accused of not using logic, but either these people who say that because this one followed this one in point of time, therefore this one must be a descendant of this one, either they're logical or I'm a nut, and I feel fine. So this confounding of succession with relationship is a very important thing. When they assume in the theory of evolution that every time you find something succeeding another in point of time, it is of necessity a descendant of that. This doesn't seem logical to me. Every year at the time of the Indianapolis Speedway race, the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company come out with a double page, or it's getting to the point now where they have to have an overleaf, a triple page spread of cars beginning about 1898 and down to the year they're talking about, and this year is 1967, of all the cars that have won the race out there. They've all been equipped with Firestone tires. So here is a succession of cars in time. But I don't think anybody in the room believes that one is descended from the other. So when you have creationists who believe that there may have been as many as 27 special creations found in the fossils, abruptly created by God in times past, then you have a very excellent way of explaining some of these things without necessarily believing in the theory of descent from simple, so-called simple animals up to man. Number 8. The completeness of the record, I think, is the next thing I want to talk about. Just briefly, because on this hangs a point as well. Remember that the high priest of evolution in America is George Gaylord Simpson, certainly the most vocal spokesman in North America. He's a Harvard professor. And without reading all of this, I had it on the screen yesterday. Remember that he says the fossil record is incomplete. And it's very incomplete. And he says that these estimates of the great incompleteness of the currently known record may give much too gloomy an impression of the usefulness of that record and of its adequacy for solving the problems of evolution. So let's get this straight, that George Gaylord Simpson says the record is incomplete. Right? Now in a college textbook, you read that there's one thing above all others that proves the theory of evolution, and that is so-called the pedigree of the horse. There isn't a college textbook extant that doesn't have the most beautiful-looking series you ever saw in your life of the pedigree of the horse. Well, first of all, they didn't go up to the side of a cliff and start chiseling and get the little fellow the size of a chihuahua dog out of the bottom layer, and then a little way up they got the one the size of a fox, and the next way up they got the one the size of a small wolf, and so on, up the line until they got up to the horse as we know them today. They got a fragment of a bone of one in Java, a bit of a foot of another in Norway, something else in Siberia, and put the whole thing together, which is quite different. However, they don't tell you this in the textbook. They give you a beautiful diagram of the pedigree of the horse. But let's say everything is what they say, that there is a horse of the... And by the way, this I think is funny. You know, the word for horse is hippus. And every time one of these guys goes out, not every time, pardon me, but frequently when one of these fellows go out and find a jawbone or an ankle bone or something of one of these things, and they say, this is another link in the pedigree of the horse, you know what they do? They give this bone a name now, or the animal from which it came a name. And more frequently, they are naming it after themselves. So you'll be reading along in the textbook, and this really makes me smile. I don't know whether it does you or not, but you'll have a thing called Eohippus. Now let's put this down. Eohippus harrowcookii. A guy named Harold Cook went out and found this bone, and so help me, he calls it Eohippus harrowcookii, or Megahippus or something, Peter Robinson. this makes me smile. I don't know. It doesn't take much to make me smile sometimes, but that does. However, that is the point that I want to make. The point is that Simpson said the record is incomplete. Now, let's think that you have one of these horses the size of a dog, dug up, say. And let's say he's pretty complete, too. Where is the evidence that also in that same strata, if you look long enough, you wouldn't also find a horse just like we have today? No evidence at all. Because Simpson says the record is incomplete. Now, they, as I told you before, they want to talk this way when they put a system for a complete record, and this way when it's incomplete. Now, I'm showing you that they say, not me, they say it's incomplete. I say if they find something in a stratum the size of a dog, they cannot prove anything because they might, if they went down the hill 10 miles, they might find in the same stratum a horse the size of a horse. Now this they don't tell you either, but this is getting awfully close to a little bit fraudulent, I think, and not pointing this out to students. Now the last point I want to make in this connection is this, and I believe this is important. Darwin said that when he thought of the evolution of the eye, it left him cold. He shook all over. How in the name of goodness an eye could evolve from nothing? You know, because it's pretty complex. You want to look into it, you know. All right, let's grant the point. Let's say that an eye came to, say, mammals through the process of evolution. I'm like Brother Whitaker. My imagination isn't good enough for that. But let's say it did. Terrific, an eye evolved. Fine. Through the circumstances of environment, you know, everything was right for this eye to be pushed up into an eye. The environment, the pressure, the temperature, the mutations, the genes, the whole business, all things were right for this eye to evolve. Terrific. That's great. And maybe somebody can believe that. But don't forget, that isn't the only case. We have animals under the sea, several fathoms, who have evolved eyes, complex eyes, often on the end of long stalks. Also, in a totally different environment, we have birds with eyes. In fact, no matter what you want to take in the animal kingdom, you can find creatures with eyes in all kinds of different environments. Now, let's say I'm a credulous fellow. Religionists are accused of having faith. Well, let's say I'm an evolutionist with tremendous faith, and I can conceive how it is that from a light-sensitive cell, this thing climbed up the ladder and got to be an eye on land. But the same thing, for goodness sakes, happened underwater, which is an entirely different environment, and this is very, 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 in my view, damaging to the theory of evolution. Maybe it's not damaging your idea, but it sure is to mine. Now tomorrow, I'm going to put this up, and I want you to think about this. When you write this down before you go, just take a minute. I want to speak to this point tomorrow when I start. Here we have two diametrically, mutually exclusive things happen, which are explained under the same theory. This is a remarkable feat, and I want to talk about it tomorrow. Change and unchange, persistence and transformation, all listed under the same hypothesis, all listed under what some people even refer to as the law of evolution. Now, if the law works for change, I want to know how it doesn't work for unchange. Okay, thank you.